Hello! It's Daisha. You guys are about to hear my conversation with pianist and all-around awesome person, Angela Dragicescu. We try to solve the unsolved mysteries of why so much music by women composers was lost to the winds of history. Can you put a wind sound in there? And now, hang on to your hats, because here's our latest episode. There's a rumor going around that classical music can be hoity-toity. But here in the classical classroom, we beg to differ.
Beethoven 5.
The idea that classical music is a zone where we have to feel restricted or we have to act in a certain way, you know, that's not going to be helpful going forward.
Isaiah is shaking with excitement.
There's just so many great parts of the opera.
He asked me to play his favorite spot in the first movement of the Brahms. And then he said, I started using those licks in my guitar solos.
How to be classical music rock stars, because there's not enough of that in this business.
Occasionally, I would plug in the mandolin to my distortion pedals.
I don't change my voice.
And talking to classical music voice.
I'm playing classical music now. I mean, it's the same 12 notes. That's what's so cool about it.
I'm Daisha Clay, a classical music newbie, and I'm trying to learn all I can about the music. Come learn with me and the classical music experts I invite into the classical classroom.
This program is about unsolved music mysteries. Whenever possible, the actual family members and police officials have participated in recreating the events. What you're about to hear is not a news broadcast.
Tonight on Unsolved Classical Mysteries Classroom, Rebecca Clark, a female composer of the early 20th century, is prevented from gaining recognition in the classical music world. We investigate why. Louise Farrunk, another female composer of the 19th century, is prevented from gaining recognition in the classical music world despite her considerable talent. We investigate why. And finally, Amy Beach, a composer in the early 20th century, is prevented from gaining recognition in the classical music world. You guessed it, we investigate. And we investigate that one too. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Classical Classroom. I'm Daisha Clay, and here with me in the studio today is Angela Dragicescu. She's a pianist, a chamber musician, and a teacher, in addition to working as a collaborative pianist with people like New York Phil Concertmaster Frank Huang. She's a big champion of new classical music and has premiered works by composers like John Mackey and William Balcom. But she most recently became a detective of sorts, unearthing the cold cases and compositions of female composers, dusting them off, and trying to figure out why they had such a hard time reaching the light of day with her project, Women Who Score. Angela, welcome to the Classical Classroom.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
So what motivated you to begin investigating these cases, and why did you start down this path?
It's a very simple answer for that. I think I strive, like any other musician, to just discover new works, new talent, new inspiration for my things. So in my work as a collaborative pianist or pianist, whatever you want to call me, I was fascinated by the music of Louise Farrunk. Having not heard of her, I have to be very ashamed to admit that I haven't heard of her. So when I picked up the music from her piano quintet, I discovered the most beautiful, beautiful music, and fascinated by the fact that such glorious music had not reached my ears sooner. Why would I have not seen it on any other CDs or programs? Mm. So it led me to want to investigate why the silence.
Mm. And you've brought a piece of evidence in today, her music. Shall we give it a listen?
Yes, the piano quintet in A minor.
Thank you. So I don't understand. This sounds like a piece of classical music. But what you're telling me is that this did not, in Louise's day, reach the light of day.
Yes.
This was not played in front of audiences. This piece, it's got like all this momentum and energy to it. So why was this not a thing? Tell us a little bit about who she was.
Yes. Well, Louise Varenk was, first of all, a fantastic pianist. She is known as being the first pianist, female pianist, that had ever gotten a job at the Paris Conservatory. Because in the 19th century, which is the reason why you haven't heard this music, compositions by women were considered really bad works, actually lesser works. Women were regarded during those days as acceptable performers, which is why Clara Schumann and other opera singers had a very prolific career as performers. But as far as the composition aspect of their lives, it was considered that a woman was a lesser being. It was unacceptable by any standards because they were inferior creatures, especially to men, right? There's many examples. Alma Mahler, who was married to Gustav Mahler, had to sign in her prenup agreement that she was never going to compose.
Oh my. Oh my. Well, but first, before we get into all of women, Louise, what motivated her to compose? Who were her influences? What was her story? And how was her story stifled?
So Louise Varenk was born in 1804, and she was the daughter of a successful sculptor, actually. So she lived in a household of artists, right? She started piano, and she worked extensively, actually, for Brahms, believe it or not. And during her days as a pianist, she was considered a child prodigy. She requested from her father to take composition lessons. But it was forbidden for any woman during those days to take composition lessons. But she was just so brilliant that she couldn't be ignored, which is incredibly interesting about all female composers of that time. They were so good and with absolutely no formal training whatsoever, right?
Well, so and just to be clear, the reason that women were unable to do this kind of training is because somebody had said, these are clearly inferior creatures, we cannot allow them to have training. Now, in my mind, if you're inferior at something, should that not warrant training? Wouldn't one want to train? What is the impetus behind this? I don't understand.
Because when somebody is assigned a certain role in society, you just don't see them anything else but that. So their roles were to be mothers, to be, you know, even in some situations, ironically, like Clara Schumann, she was actually supporting the household. She was the breadwinner of the household, right? But you would not know, right? So the role was for the woman to be a mother, and it was okay for them to perform because it was considered like a social event. But you wouldn't want to train somebody who, you know, only has a specific role.
I see.
It was just a predestined, somebody else was dictating the fate of what they were going to be, right?
I see. And so when you first heard the music of Louise Varenk, Varenk,
they're both very much acceptable.
You say potato, I say potato. So when you first heard this, you, as a contemporary person, thought to yourself, why the hell haven't I heard this music before?
Exactly.
This is really good. I'm moved by this.
I was very intrigued by her story. So a couple of details that I feel that will be absolutely chilling was that, so as a young girl, she had to take compositions lessons in secret, right? So she was taken by her father to this composition professor at the Paris Conservatory, who said, your daughter is a genius, but I'm not allowed to teach her. So she took composition lessons in secret, right? So she wanted really badly to compose. So eventually she ended up composing a lot more than performing, and she would take her works everywhere, and they would just not be accepted. They would not be performed. So everything about these women's paths, what's similar about everyone for the late 19th century is that no matter how many doors were closed, they would always find another one to open or build or break and just, you know, there were so many blocks in their way, but they would always have to overcome it. And you have to understand also that not being officially trained, not being taught composition lessons at a major institution was also yet another excuse why the music wasn't good, right? So it was not performed, it was not published.
Wait. So they're saying, sorry, we can't perform your music because you haven't received training and you don't have this stamp of approval from this official. But also the official organization won't let you be trained.
Exactly. Yes.
I don't know if you guys can hear this over the mic, but that's the sound of my eyes rolling back in my head. Please continue.
Yes. And what was really heartbreaking is that once she would take this music to a concert hall. So eventually, you know, after much insistence and much push, because obviously they were just too good to be ignored. And that was the most important aspect of their lives. They were just so good that even without the training, without all that, it was just, they were prodigies, some of them. And the major concert halls, right, like in Paris, even Salle Courtauld or Salle Gaveau said, we're very sorry, but you can only have this piece performed if it's under the name of a male.
What?
Yeah.
Okay. And so did she do that? Did she?
She did not. And that's one of the reasons why I'm so fascinated with her, because,
because she said no to that.
She did not take no for an answer. She found more ways to reinvent what she was doing, right?
Yeah.
After, in the late 1900s, pieces of female composers started to be performed, but they were under severe scrutiny by critics. Mm. So the next phase in her life was to have her works performed and receive the most horrible reviews, right? So that was another very, very sad thing.
Wow,
eventually,
so many
she realized,
rules.
And she realized, you know, that the only way she could be respected was if she got the job at the Paris Conservatory. And she finally got the title of being the first pianist, female woman composer that ever got that actually piano professorship at the Paris Conservatory. And she was paid actually half of what the male composers were making and performers, right?
So, well, but you know, she should have been grateful to get any salary at all.
Of course, especially with that job. I mean, she went down in history as being one of the most important composers of the 20th century. But
she kind of took one for the team, didn't she?
She did, she did. And actually, I must say, because it's very important for our listeners to know, that it is because of Louise Farrenc that any chamber music pianist, a collaborative pianist, or any formation of more than one instrument, but for pianists in particularly, that we actually get equal pay and almost an equal role these days, because she fought. She was a champion of the pianist as a performer in any context.
Huh. Yeah. So interesting. Well, so the case of Louise Farrenc still remains open to this day.
Yes,
her music is still seeking performers and performance spaces and exposure. Let's move on to another case. What was the next case that you stumbled upon?
Well, the next case actually that I found that had a connection with Louise Farrenc because of how her music came to our ears, in the sense that the music of Louise Farrenc after her death was put aside for 100 years and wasn't discovered until later. And the similar fate, which was kind of a common fate for most female composers of that time, was the fate that Rebecca Clark actually experienced.
Rebecca Clark.
Who was a pioneer, because she was the first female violist of those days and the first female violist to ever be part of an all-female quartet.
Okay.
Being a violinist during those days, like Maud Powell was a phenomenal virtuoso violinist, was not so uncommon, but to be a violist during those days was really uncommon.
Mm.
So the British composer Rebecca Clark was a pioneer in her field as a performer as well as a composer.
I see. And I am curious, speaking of her as a performer, this is something that I've never really understood and that I've encountered a lot. Why were women accepted as performers but not as composers? I've never understood that. It was okay for you to play the piano and to even tour in a lot of cases, but not to compose.
in my personal opinion, which I'm sure most music historians would agree because that's what inspired me to do the same research, is that performing was a social event very much. When you look at the history of chamber music and musique de chambre, which was basically in salons, right? This was meant for very private settings, very intimate settings. And so women playing. And if you look even back in the 14th, 15th century, you have a lot of paintings of the French school with women with a lyre or a harpsichord. So these were times where music was an entertainment, but mostly for our own ears, right? You would do it at home and you would do it in the presence. And then it evolved into the woman being on stage. They were also able to make money out of that because they were teaching lessons too, right? So it became more acceptable because it had a very long history of it happening, right? So when it started even with Mozart's sister playing at the court, where we have the wonderful four fan piano sonatas, where they were trying to have a fun time together. So their fun times was to compose.
I see.
But Nana was actually playing, right? Mm. So it was something they would see a lot, right? And that goes back in the 17th, 18th century.
So people were just kind of
accepted.
Used to it.
It was used to it. Exactly.
Okay, that's, I gotcha.
Yeah, that's what it is. It was just more accepted. But composition has to do with a creative mind. It has to do with your inspiration, with your...
It's an intellectual pursuit.
It's an intellectual, yes, it's an intellectual preoccupation.
Okay. Huh. That reminds me a lot of sports, like what goes on in the world of sports.
Exactly.
And it's like, people from different groups in society were allowed to play, and this is still the case, but not so much allowed to be the managers of teams.
Exactly.
Yeah. So it's cool for them to be out there performing and, you know, making sure that everybody has a good time.
Yes.
But
I hate to point this out because we're actually tiptoeing around the elephant in the room, but I mean... the conclusion that I drew is that it was okay for the service to be provided, for basically the work to be done. But when it comes to taking credit for something, that was what was not okay, right? So it's one thing to play some things, to play some concerts, but when you actually compose and you have something your own, it's like, I created this. That's
right.
A much more powerful weapon, in quotes, I mean, than the one of interpreting.
Well, let's listen to one of Rebecca's pieces now. What are we about to hear?
We're about to hear her very famous viola sonata from 1919.
This is really cool. So I really dug how that piece just like started out of the gate really strong, and then it kind of like moves into that softer bit, and then there was like, it sounded almost like they were using like an Ableton device, you know, where it like loops and you're playing with yourself, but I'm guessing that's two violas at the same time or two instruments?
No, it's actually one, but I think it's just an effect that you're perceiving. Like, how she wrote it. Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah, that's really cool. She was ahead of... I personally discovered in this sonata that how much she was ahead of her time in terms of...
Yeah.
You know, I'm not a violist, obviously, but I would think that most violists would agree that it's well written for the instrument.
Yeah, so it sounds like a very contemporary piece, something that you might hear on like a new music channel or something like that. So tell me who this future woman was.
Yes, so Rebecca Clark, a British composer, British violist, you know. The piece that you heard was actually written in 1919 because I think that Rebecca Clark died in the 70s. So Rebecca Clark experienced severe depression. Actually, she was very much affected by the fact that her music was basically kept from seeing the light of day, I was going to say, but to come to our ears. What happened is actually in this piece is very interesting to me, is that this was what she called my one little whiff of success. She was incredibly pessimistic because of what she had experienced, particularly because this piece in 1919 tied for first place in a competition sponsored by a really wealthy woman. Her name is Elizabeth Coolidge, actually. Mm-hmm. And when they discovered that the piece that won was by a female composer, Miss Coolidge took it off and replaced it with the famous Ernst Bloch Suite 1919, that, you know, by a male composer.
Wait a minute. So another lady pulled it off instead of going, "You go, girl."
Exactly. Yeah.
That makes me so mad.
Well, it happens. I mean, we have to stay united if we want something to persevere, right, and have success. But it's not an unknown fact that, females have been at times, against each other, right? In this particular case, Miss Coolidge was, very famous in the socialite circles. She was very known and for being so rich, and she's actually the founder of that competition. Of course, I'm sure it wasn't necessarily a female thing as much as what will the world think that a woman's composer won this competition, right?
Right, and that I let that happen.
Exactly. And it is it really sent Rebecca Clark into quite of a depression. And there's a stunning interview with her I've discovered online, actually, how she talks about just how inferior she thought. It really got to her. She really did not think that she was that good. I mean, after so much trial and error, and she was also abused. She would get a lot of spanking, like I would call it, but from her father because she wanted to pursue composition. She was thrown in the streets at the age of 16 because she pursued composition. I mean, she was on her own. Yeah.
Wow. So exactly. She was kicked out of her house for pursuing her art.
Exactly.
I can see why she was.
She's very pessimistic, Miss Coolidge actually asked her to come back, and she wrote another piece for the same competition about 20-something years later, who wasn't as good, but it still never got a chance to be heard. And this viola sonata discovered much later. It was actually revived in the viola repertoire many years after her death. I mean, I have personally heard of it about 10 years ago, and it made a comeback a little bit before that, not so soon. But what I'm saying is it was in the 90s that it started. I mean, and if you think about it, it was written in 1919. So it's so sad that after her death, it just got put somewhere on a dusty shelf somewhere.
Oh, my God.
It's very sad. It's very sad because it's just such good music. And unbelievable.
So Rebecca Clark's case also still remains open. Just taking a little break here to ask a very important question. Have you seen our new website? It's classicalclassroomshow.com, and we love it so much. It was designed by our good friends at New Y. If you too want an awesome website or some help getting the word out to the world about your widget business, head over to classicalclassroomshow.com/NW. That's N as in new and W as in Y. All right, now back to our regularly scheduled program. In the time that we have left, you have two other cases that we need to dig into a little bit. Which would you like to talk about next?
Well, I would, because we're sort of within that time frame. I mean, Miss Clark died a little bit later than Amy Beach. I would like to go on to Amy Beach because she was an American composer and pianist. She was born in the United States. And the reason she caught my eye is that she was the first successful American female composer. Actually, she's the leader of the feminist movement in composition.
And when did she write?
In the United States.
When was she writing?
She was born in 1867, died in 1944. And the majority of the best works were in early 20th century, 1900s and on, right? Okay. So you see the 1900s and 1919, the overlap with Rebecca Clark, right?
Were there any, sorry to keep interrupting you, but I'm just curious if things were any better in the brave new world of America. I mean, I guess it wasn't that new at the time, but the relatively new world than it was in Europe, where things were so much more like there's this long, long tradition of hundreds of years. Whereas in America, in the US, like there's this opportunity to do things better. Did we?
I think so.
Oh, that's great.
Because in 1867, Boston Symphony actually, no, sorry, 1896, Boston, because that was the year she was born. She couldn't have done that. 1896 was the year that Boston Symphony premiered her Gaelic Symphony.
Yeah.
And that was the first time that any United States major orchestra, and any orchestra in the United States actually, premiered a composition by a female composer.
Wow.
And it's one thing to have had sonatas. It's another thing to have had symphonies. And
yeah.
She was just, you know, so I find that to be in itself a success, because up until that point, there was no other European orchestra that had performed large scale works or any sort. Mm. With Ethel Smyth, she had an opera performed much later in England, a female composer predominantly for vocal works. And it was a lot later. But if you think about it, 1896, that's pretty revolutionary in my view.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, there's just so few incidents of this nature. Mm-hmm. So situations like that it doesn't make up for a lot of other things that she experienced.
Yeah. Well, let's give a listen to this piece of evidence, I mean music, that you brought in. Will you tell us what we're about to hear?
Yes, yes. I was fascinated by this piece. It's the beautiful romance, Opus 23, for violin and piano.
But that sounds somehow more American to me. I don't know. Why am I hearing that? Can you tell me why? I think, is that just because you've told me that Amy Beach is from America and I'm imagining things?
Yes, of course it could be. But she definitely focused majority of her composition on American tunes. And what's important to know is that she was the first female composer who had absolutely no training or attempt for any European training.
Uh-huh.
So she was basically American taught, self-taught, right? She didn't have the means to travel, obviously, so far, right?
Right.
So the fact that she was, that's why she's so quintessential American, the fact that she was here and had heard the wonderful tunes from hymns and folk tunes and that, are so available to us is... They're found in majority of her works.
Huh.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. So that's really coming across in her music, too, for some reason that I don't understand. I hear that.
Sammy Beach, as opposed to Rebecca Clark, wasn't a much stronger individual in the sense that the discrimination that she experienced in her life as a composer, she didn't let it affect her very much.
Okay.
For example, there is a Carnegie Hall performance of her works, and she refused to be called on the program by a male name, right? So she refused it, and then they refused to actually publish the programs. So before she performed her own piece, she announced it herself, saying, "I am the woman." Yes, and so she was so
she basically ran up
strong. Yeah,
she ran stole up, the mic, yeah. And she was like, "This was me.
This is me." Yeah, and it's just so wonderful, right? I mean, she just had. First of all, she was, you know, she was married to a man that was actually, she was smart in the sense that he was encouraging her career as long as it didn't necessarily mean composition. But she had gathered enough money performing, right? He encouraged her performing career where she was taking in secret, like composition lessons. Yeah. And then he died. And it's really interesting because after he died, and this was an arranged marriage, she immediately changed her name to her maiden name. And then she pursued composition fiercely. And she championed her own works. And she was a pianist of Maud Powell, who was the first female virtuoso violinist of the United States and the world before anybody else, right? I mean, we know of Fritz Kreisler and other, but this is the woman who was one of the biggest virtuoso violinists of the time. And Amy Beach toured with her. I mean, and they were performing Amy Beach's compositions. In fact, Maud Powell and Amy Beach premiered this piece.
Wow.
It was so beautiful, yes. And the audience loved it so much that they wanted it again and again. And actually, they played it 4 times.
Dang!
Exactly.
That's what. Wow. Yeah. They had like lighters up in the air.
I know. So she was like, she's just a very strong woman. And, you know, she had a mother who was a pianist. So that's who gave her, you know, piano lessons. And, you know, she basically, you know, accepted the, you know, to be a good wife and of the time. And she actually refused to have children, which was very unusual at the time. Mm-hmm. She was just very, she did not fit the pattern in any way. And she was just quite a force to be reckoned with during her time. So different upbringing, but also different person than Rebecca Clark, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
I could see how two women of experiencing the same things, but one was just... it's just stronger than the other because of childhood trauma, of course.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. That's really something. Women of would you say equal caliber as composers, but who had wildly different experiences in their early
life. I mean, they both had a lot of barriers in their ways, a lot of blocks, right?
Right.
I mean, actually, all of them. It's just that I think, in retrospect, the fact that Amy Beach was on this side of the pond, I think because Boston Symphony did premiere her work, I think they were just slightly easier. Yeah. Slightly easier.
Right. And it sounds like she had kind of the chutzpah, the like...
Exactly.
Inner fortitude that she needed to kind of like say, you know what, whatever.
Yes.
With your...
Yes.
You know, and do her thing. So let's move on to our final case, that of one Clara Schumann. Can you introduce her for us?
Yes, Clara Schumann, the wife of Robert Schumann. She is known as a composer, but primarily known actually as one of the most distinguished pianists of the Romantic era. And it's very interesting because we're making like a comeback, right? We started during the times of Ries Farang, 19th century. Clara is also part of that time. She was born in 1819 and died in 1896, so late 19th century. And she was a wonderful mother. She actually, you know, she loved Robert Schumann very much. They loved each other very much. It was a beautiful love story. But because of his psychological problems, she was quite of a tortured soul because he has suffered from schizophrenia. And she supported his composition by making a lot of money to keep the household. And I think it was about maybe 11 children, and some of them died. And in a personal note in one of her diaries.
Wait a minute. 11 children?
Yes.
Is that what you just said to me?
Yes. There's a lot of kids.
Okay, sorry.
Had.
I just wanted to make sure I heard that right.
Yeah, wow. They had a lot of children. And there is a note in which she says, and as much as we know it, and in the classical music world, we know about their love story. We know about their success. We know how much they encouraged Brahms. We love them. I mean, it's like this admiration for both Clara and Robert Schumann. It was hard for me to read in one of her diary notes that, you know, I presented these songs to, which was a leader, art songs, to Robert, and he just dismissed them as being like what are you thinking? What are you doing, right?
Robert,
he later encouraged
no.
her more, but it was a condition that she would give up composition as well, right? And you hear this music and it's absolutely glorious, right? And you imagine her having to deal with supporting the family, making money, supporting him, mm-hmm. knowing that behind his success wasn't just mm-hmm. his genius, but it was a woman that kept it all together.
Mm-hmm.
Who never had a chance. I mean, it's just, it's really, really such a powerful, powerful
yeah.
thing
so,
to grasp.
So, with Clara, she not only was the support staff for Robert Schumann mm-hmm. and his children and kept him going, but then her own creative endeavors
yes.
were suppressed
stifled.
By the very person that she supported.
Yes, and he loved her. I mean, it was just something, you know, and she actually, what she wrote, she says, I once believed that I possessed creative talent, but I have given up this idea. A woman must not desire to compose. There has never yet been one able to do so. Should I expect to be the one? And then Robert Schumann actually expressed his concern about,
wait a minute. Yeah. So she thought that there were no other women composing? But Claire, there were women composing. This is so heartbreaking.
And she's the reason why, in many ways, Louise Farenc was more brave to continue what she... And she, Clara Schumann, is the reason why other female composers later use her as a model.
Mm.
I mean, it's just really, really sad. And Robert Schumann actually says Clara has composed a series of small pieces which show a musical and tender ingenuity such as she has never attained before. But to have children and a husband, that just doesn't go with composition. She cannot work at it regularly. And I'm really often disturbed to think of how many profound ideas are lost. Profound ideas of his are lost because she cannot balance our life.
You guys, I seriously just had the I want to throw my headphones on the floor right now. Wow.
I know. It's wow. Very, very sad.
Okay. All right. So what happened? How did her music eventually eke out?
It was, I believe, one of her first publications, which was easy because he, because of his reputation during his time, he had easier access to publishing, right? It was Robert Schumann. They decided to publish a collection together, sort of like a love project of Lieder. And
okay.
that's when her work started going out and being performed, right?
Yeah.
Because it was like, oh, this is our anniversary gift, sort of saying, let's just publish together something. So eventually he came around.
Okay.
But the idea, which I want listeners to hear, is how unheard of it was. I mean, it was just sort of like, why would you want to do that? I mean, it was just inconceivable, right? It was just, it's so sad. It's really, really sad to know that the force that drives us to be the musicians that we are, right? The
mm-hmm.
creativity. It's just clipped and our wings are clipped and it's stifled and it's just kept in the dark on purpose. That's really, really hard. It's really hard.
Let's hear a piece of Clara's music as we bring this story to a close. What will we be hearing?
We're about to hear another romance, actually part of a set of three romances, Opus 28, for violin and piano. Thank you.
I mean, that sounds like just a little side project to me. That was sarcasm, by the way.
Oh.
Angela's face. No, that was lovely. That was... Okay, I'm going to try to calm down after hearing everything that you've just told me. So, now that you have told me about these four unsolved mysteries, these four women whose music I personally cannot figure out why is not being played more. Also, that was terrible English. So, now you, with your new project, Women Who Score, you are giving these pieces their due attention. You're bringing them
yes.
to audiences. That's one component of what you're doing, but you're also taking preventative measures to make sure that this does not happen in the future and that there are fewer unsolved mysteries of this kind. Tell
exactly.
me about that.
About a year and a half ago, with the music of Louise Farenc, the inspiration about the women who score project came about. I had the exact same reaction as you had. Really, I was just
beside
speechless.
Yourself.
Exactly, because I can't find my words even now. So we decided to create a concert series. To our surprise, it was the first concert series of this format in the States, actually, and in the world. Because there, and I know this sounds very pretentious, but it's true in the sense that a lot of concert series that feature women composers have sort of like a one-off event or one day. And I discovered that we have plenty of material, right, to create a series that's focused around female composers, bringing to light the works such as the ones that you heard today that didn't really get their recognition during those times. I want people to experience that if they close their eyes and listen to this music, it doesn't really matter to them. They won't be able to tell if it's a woman or a man. And that's what I want the audience to understand, that we're bringing the talent to light, and it's just justice, right? And that we have to also acknowledge that more works by female composers need to happen. So we're also commissioning new works. Besides performances of older works, we're commissioning new works because while female composers of the 20th century and the 21st century are experiencing a lot of success. You know, they're Grammy winners, but there are just so few of them, and they're still fighting with, well, let's just say prejudice in that department. It was only in 2012 that the Met staged a work by a female composer named Kaija Saariaho, who is a wonderful Finnish composer, and it was after probably like 30 or 40 years. I mean, they did something, and forgive my math, it's probably more than that. They did something in 1939 with Ethel Smith. And after that, they didn't want to ever do it again. And this is the Met, right? And this is a woman that has won multiple prizes.
Yeah.
And so you see, it's because, I mean, I'm not trying to bash anybody, of course, but I'm saying it has to become in our common language. Uh-huh. We stop thinking about whether it's a man or a woman, but we just start promote talent.
Or
and
if it's
through
a person
that
of
equality,
color, or
exactly.
if it's an LGBT person, or if it's like, it's the work.
It is the work. Yeah.
That's what's
And
important.
It is the fact that you don't want to hear the work that ultimately leads to inequality and prejudice, and that's what happens, right? Uh-huh. That's because you start noticing, oh, this happens to, you know, women composers. Oh, okay, that's a problem right there, right?
Mm.
So we are focusing on equality in that sense, but through the talent that has never been, through the works that have never been heard.
Yeah. Well, Angela Dragicic, I thank you very much for coming in here and teaching me about these unsolved mysteries. And I hope that our listeners will help to close these cases by going to performances of these works. And maybe, if they're here in Seattle, going to one of your Women Who Score performances.
And lots of details about that can be found on our website, which is www.womenwhoscore.org. And many empowering stories and many details about our upcoming concerts.
All right, everybody, that does it for this episode of Unsolved Classical Mysteries Classroom. For more Classroom, go to classicalclassroomshow.com. You can find everything you ever wanted to know and maybe some things that you didn't want to know about the show there, including ways to connect with us. You can email us at classicalclassroomshow@gmail.com, and please do, we'd love to hear from you. Thanks today to our new home, King FM in Seattle, for giving us a friendly wink and a thumbs up. Thanks to our birthplace, Houston Public Media. Thanks to Angela Dragicescu for being on the show. Thanks to Hair by Javier, the hobbyist hair out there. Thanks to me for saying words, but most of all, thanks to you for listening. We'll catch you next time.